Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I look for what's happening on the spiritual frontiers, how we are evolving into a new consciousness. So I look for people who are really at the cutting edge, who are taking a lot of the wisdom traditions that have already gone down and integrating them into a new form, into a new fashion, because we're moving into a new time, and I feel none of the old forms of spirituality, of consciousness, are really working anymore. They seem to not have the same pull and drive and punch that they used to have, and that's why there's this big split between fundamentalisms and fundamentalistic type of thinking and those looking for new consciousness, new awakenings. So tonight's show is going to be a pickup on a talk that a guy named Philip Lipitz is doing. And Philip Lipitz is an old friend of mine that I met in India. And let me just give you a little background on him. He is teaching what do you do after enlightenment. So he says, after a fully awakened soul reaches out to other souls, what's the next doorway? What's the next opening? How do we progress as a collective consciousness? That's at least what I think he's talking about. So we're going to be listening in on this conference call, and then I'll be asking Philip some questions towards the end of it. So, Don, let's see if we can tune into the conference call. And let's see what we have Philip Lipitz saying on the conference call. Okay.
Okay. I'm going to mute everybody again. Hang on.
Hey, Philip. How are you?
Yeah, hi. I'm in the middle of a call. Let me just go on, okay?
Sure, go ahead. Yeah.
Hi, Alan.
Hi. I'm not hearing Philip on this call.
So,
go ahead.
The problem we all have is that when we think of spirituality, we think of studentship. We think of spirituality as achieving an infinite series of higher and higher goals. I'll achieve this spiritual gift, and then I'll get this spiritual gift, and then I'll get this spiritual gift, and I'll get that spiritual gift. And these spiritual gifts that you keep talking about are all different versions of being a student. You can be a higher level student or a lower level student, but they're being a student. It's like paying attention to saying you want a car that can go on a road, but not talk about where that road is going to go. And people are very, 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 very reluctant to give up that image that they have of being a student. They can only think of spirituality in terms of an infinity of goals that are accessible to them within spirituality. The problem is it truly is an infinity of not goals, but an infinity of bits of processes and bits of information that you can do. And so it's a great trap. Spirituality is a honey trap. It's not like a tar pit of the world. It's a honey trap, but it's just as sticky. You get caught in the love of doing processes. You get caught in opening up new energy channels, you get caught in what you see as making yourself bigger and bigger and bigger and stronger and stronger and stronger all the time. The problem that you have with this approach is that what good is it to be strong if you're not implementing it in the world? what good is it to have gained strength if you're constantly saying, oh, I'm not strong, I'm so weak, I have to get more and more and more and more and more and more. And that's what people have become. They've become perpetual spiritual students. And that has created a huge, huge, huge illusion around spirituality. Because if you are a perpetual student, then you don't want to be in the world. You want to be constantly gaining more and more and more energy. You want to be constantly gaining more and more power, more and more knowledge. But what good are those things if you don't implement them in the world? In fact, the only way to make to go through that infinity of knowledge quickly is to have a goal in mind of how you want to implement them in the world. What is it you want that energy for? What is it you want to do? And if you know that, you can make your way through that path. Then you're in the situation where you can simultaneously hold the spiritual and the human. Most people rebel from the idea of simultaneously holding the spiritual and the human. They think that that's antithetical to being a spiritual person. Well, it's antithetical to being a spiritual student, but it's not against being a saint. See, a saint is a person who knows how to use the energy in the world. Well, to know how to use the energy in the world, you have to have worldly consciousness. You can't be afraid of the world. You have to be embracing of the world. In fact, unless you embrace the world, the energy that you have will not flow properly. It'll flow properly only when you're using it to do good in the world. You see, if you're just acquiring energy, you're just being a student and doing process after process, after process, after process, after process, it's building up, but where can it go? You say, well, I do healings. That'll take care of it. No, no, that won't take care of it. It won't take care of it because that's not really allowing for a channel that all of the energy that you've acquired can flow through. You're essentially just saying, I have this big bucket, here's a teaspoon. I'm only going to use a teaspoon of the water inside that big bucket. So, being able to live in the world is actually a spiritual necessity. It gets you out of the honey trap of being a perpetual spiritual student. You have to be able to hold the two of them simultaneously. Only then are you truly an enlightened person. Only then are you have a person of power. You see, the paradox is that spiritual students, as they get higher and higher and higher, they have greater and greater and greater spiritual experiences, wonderful spiritual experiences. They love it. They love it. You know, the angels sit there and give you the information, and you go, I don't want anyone else to interrupt me. I'm getting more and more information. You know, Buddha sat for how many years sitting there listening as the Divine Mother, and the angels told him.
I am going back to Philip Lippitz, but while we're reconnecting, Philip, I'm going to just talk to my friend Virginia Quintal, who's a mystic from Brazil here, and she's had many wonderful adventures all over the world. You know, one thing that you were telling me, Virginia, was that starting with Buckminster Fuller, can you tell me how he, that whole thing where he was going to commit suicide, and then he had this great vision, and he was transformed. So here, just relay that story and give a little background about who you are.
Okay, I was studying with the architect Doxiadis in Athens, and every summer he had a beautiful boat trip with lots of teachers and students, including Buckminster Fuller and Margaret Mead for 2 different years. And we chatted, and he told me a story.
Buckminster Fuller.
Yeah, Bucky Fuller told me a lovely story that when he was around 50 years old, he put a big rock on his neck and went to the lake by his university and was going to jump in the lake with the rock. And then an angel appeared and asked him, "Why are you doing that, Bucky, Buckminster Fuller? You should present your work of the geodesic dome and make the world happier." Anyway, so he listened to the angel, and he tied the beautiful rock out of his neck and went home, and next day he presented the geodesic dome to the world. And he told me this story on a little table in an island of Athens, somewhere in the islands.
Well, you've had so many interesting experiences in your life as an architect, as an artist, as a musician, and growing up in Brazil as it was becoming a real nation from being a colony. What was some of the most exciting adventures you had in Brazil as a young woman, and, you know, coming from a good family, politicians, philosophers, psychologists? Tell me a little bit about that growing up, and maybe your father, who was quite a statesman.
Yeah, my father was very mystical. He loved Krishnamurti, and he invited him to come up to the great mountain with Jesus' statue on top.
What do you call that mountain?
Yeah, the Christ Mountain. And he invited the philosopher. When the philosopher refused a castle in Holland.
In Krishnamurti.
Yeah. He refused the castle and the money, hundreds of dollars, thousands of dollars. And he came to Rio in 1925. Then he came again in 1946.
Krishnamurti.
Yes. And he spoke. He was very good friends with the Dutch people from my father's family, Boak Jolanda, from Holland. Anyway, that was fascinating in my life. I was raised with that kind of energy. And
what was your father like?
Oh, my father loved philosophy. He loved Krishnamurti, and he loved the aspect of Christianity too, you know, the curious aspect. He was a curious, sort of a magician. My father was a holy, adorable man, very, always laughing at problems and trying to be humble as much as he could.
So what was your spiritual philosophy? I mean, Brazil is a Christian, Catholic country, Roman Catholic, but somehow you were able to find something else for yourself. How did you do that, and what is your religion now?
Well, my father did lots of films about the mystic men, like John of God was one of them. My father used to visit him in the early days and make films. And he did lots of films and brought them back so we could see the films. And he showed me a great musician from old worlds, you know, old civilizations, like marvelous pianists. And he used to show me those films of the piano technique, you know, the Russia, etc. My father was a lovely chess champion. of the world, but his father never allowed him to leave Rio.
But what about your spiritual tradition? Where'd that come in, your spirituality?
Well, my spirituality comes straight from my father. He was also always very spiritual.
In what way?
He was spiritual in the sense that he was never totally with one thing or the other. Like, he helped lots of poor people. He adopted a poor boy from Minas that slept in front of his office that prepared medications with his brother for the pharmacies. And he adopted this boy, and this boy taught us lots. He lived with us. My father was a very interesting man from Pernambuco.
So he wasn't a Catholic, your father. He had a bigger vision of spirituality.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a bigger vision. He was Catholic, but he never stuck to anything. He was into visiting the popes, visiting the chess champions with me. When I was very little, we spent hours walking through chess, millions of games. And then I would ask him, "Oh, Dad, why don't you play, show me how to play chess?" He said, "Oh, don't worry about learning. Just observe and enjoy." And we walked miles and miles with hundreds of games.
But what was your first mystical experience? Because you've had many. What opened you up to this mysticism?
Oh, that is a very profound question. Very profound. I used to see lots of entities come out of the ocean, like my grandson, August. I saw him come out of the water in Arpoador by Ipanema. When I was 10 years old, he came out and looked at me, and he introduced himself to me. So nowadays, when I'm with him, I'm so happy, you know. I know him from a long time.
And what else happened to you? You saw angels, you saw...
I saw lots of spirits in the water, and I saw also the great shark that swam in front of us, me and my brother. We saw an enormous, like meters, long shark, white. And then a few minutes later, the guardians were saying, "Get out of the water. There's a very dangerous shark going around." But we saw him right in front of us pass by. And we saw also flying saucers. Me and my brother on the window at night, we used to watch, and we saw three times we saw the flying saucers go by. And it was astounding.
Did you have any personal contact with the flying saucers? Did they come to you? Do you remember? Because I know I have in New York. They did come, and I did have a visitation, I feel, with one of these beings. And because I think it's happening all over the world. What were your encounters like? But also more of these experiences, because you've had a lifetime of amazing experiences.
Yeah. Well, I had once, and I'm still not sure in this time now whether it's a dream or a reality, that one of the flying saucers came down, and we were looking at several clothes. They were walking with beautiful, fine clothes, different. And the energy was of another realm, very mysterious. Also, once I met a woman in Bahia that had been with several flying saucers. And she told us the details of how they also descended, and we had wonderful energy there. And one day, too, I went to a Bahia medium magic man, and when I...
A mediumship man.
And when I came home to Itaparica Island, I was in the house of Santa Teresa. That was a beautiful hotel of my friend Jimmy Valkos. Anyway, when I was walking in the water, I saw the beautiful figure of Jesus just walking, and the water got all into orangey and purple. It was just magic. And he walked along, and it was heaven. Things like that, it's hard to repeat the experience.
Mm. But you were into Osho, Rajneesh, Bhagwan. And,
oh, yeah.
And then recently Taoism. So all these different things, how did they change you? Well, tell me about your experiences with Osho. That sounds really interesting.
Well, Osho, I gave him lots of sheep from my little farm. You know, I put nice bells on the sheep. And me and my daughters, we drove the sheep there with a nice guy, a driver. And Osho was a very mystical man. One day when he was talking, all dressed in white, I saw the whole room get white, and he disappeared from the chair, and all the observers, the people watching him, disappeared. Everything was white. So that was an extraordinary time I will never forget. Yeah, everything turned white.
were you a sannyasin? Were you a devotee?
Yeah, I was a sannyasin. And I translated a book for him in Portuguese, My Way, The Way of the White Cloud.
But what was he like as a person, Osho?
Osho, when he came to Oregon, he was very slow. He spoke in a very slow level, but very entertaining, very intense. And we all always had a silence time where we all felt the energy together, just breathing with him. It was a great blessing, for sure. Mm-hmm. For sure.
How did you then become a Taoist? What was that path like?
Well, one day I was swimming and this Chinese boy came to the bus where I was waiting for the bus, and he said, "You must not receive any rain after such a warm experience." So he came to my house, had tea, and then he brought lots of Taiwan guests that introduced me to the Tao. And ever since then I love the Tao that came from China to Taiwan. The Tao origin of the purity of Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu, Confucius, etc.
So you were initiated into the Tao.
Yeah.
What is that? How did that happen?
Well, fortunately, meeting this Chinese young man, he introduced me to the Tao people that invited me to an initiation by receiving the Tao from the master. And when you receive the Tao, the master burns your name with your date of birth, and it's a beautiful ceremony. And after, he blesses all your chakras in the front and all your chakras in the back. And the burning the name means all your past incarnation efforts and karma disappears, and this incarnation becomes pure and free from any anxiety, any things to continue, any karma. It burns everything. Mm. And you become very light and very here now in the present.
Mm. And how do you feel differently after that?
Well, after I received the Tao, lots and lots of things changed. All my daughters received the Tao, my little grandson also. And life becomes vegetarian 100%, and just appreciating the full moon and the no moon. That's when the ceremony at midnight, you can do it at home, offer fruits and flowers and holy water to the divinity every 2 weeks. And to go to a Tao ceremony is beautiful. We polish the holy lamps before midnight, then we arrange all the fruits that are washed, beautifully washed, all the flowers, and at midnight we make a devotion to Lao Tzu, Lao Mu, Chuang Tzu, and the holy guardian angel. It's magical.
Do you do this every full moon? You still do it?
Well, I am invited quite often in Vancouver to the Holy House, and I like to go whenever I have the energy to go before midnight. And I have a beautiful dark blue gown, which is my advance time, because I like to polish the holy lamp and to help the offering. And sometimes I put my gown with them. We pray, and then slowly we offer one thing at a time. It's very ancient Chinese prayers, men and women together, one on each side, and it's beautiful.
So would you say you've lived a spiritual life? And how then can you help other people live that spiritual life?
That is a very profound question. Because I believe, and the Tao Master has spoken many times, that from now to 2012, we are really going through what the Mayans have predicted, a sort of an end of an era comes in now. We are going through the end of an era. So 2009, 10, 11, 12 will be extremely intense. And we are all feeling that, the change of time, the change of energy. There are better babies being born that are highly spiritual. There are hundreds of kind of angels, saints, ancestors reincarnating now through the children. So the children being born now are very spiritually high. The Master has told that. They are coming to really help the world. So we are going through that. And the negative energy of the wars and the money with weapons and all the BS is in an intense battle with the extremely positive times of the Mayan tradition of the changing time, which is happening now.
So, yeah, a lot of people I've talked to on this program about 2012, and everyone has their own idea about... I don't think it's a negative time. I think it's quite a time
of... Yeah, more fun.
But what do you... When you tune in psychically to that, what do you get?
I get that our time now is so much easier to be with people. Like, when I am in New York, I love... Wherever I go, I love the people. We smile. We can't express the love we have for each other. You know, for one another, much more. I find that's very strong in New York. New York has a wonderful spiritual energy. And I find the energy of Adidas Amraj, who died in 2008, November 28th. He is very strong now, coming... And lots of masters that I met, they say he is very strong with the positive energy of the world now. He wants to help save the world, too, because we are under sort of a negative, too, with the Mayan tradition that the Mayans predicted of the harshness of our conflict. There's a lot of good, like the good is more stronger now and more positive than the bad. The bad is waste of money, waste of time, waste of energy in stupid weapons, money, selling wars and garbage, and etc. That is has to diminish with the goodness and the love and the exhilaration of our beautiful world, in other words.
So this whole time is a kind of preparation, this kind of duality we're moving into, this very high, open experience. You know, people, the world is coming together. The global village, as Marshall McLuhan said, is coming into. And this other side of the economic meltdowns and the climate and the pollution and the greed and the corruption. So we see a real polarity of consciousness here, don't we?
Yes.
So what will bring that all together, and what does it look like after 2012 to you?
I think we have a very great opportunity to see more light. There's a lot of light at night and visions like flying stars. Sometimes when I look at night and observe, meditate, I see beautiful lights. So I think our attention, if we spend more time focusing on the Omar Khayyam style, things get better, have to get more meaningful, more beautiful.
And also, I think that getting back to some of the traditions you're from, it's the time of the feminine, the divine feminine. And your great uncle, was it, wrote that beautiful poem in Portuguese about the Divine Mother standing there.
Yes.
In front of, if could you recite that poem,
sure,
in Portuguese and then translate it?
Yeah.
And well, first tell people who your great grandfather was, what kind of great poet mystic he was.
Oh, thank you. My great grand uncle Antero de Quental, he was highly mystic. He became a Taoist too, Confucius. He loved Confucius. He loved the other lines from Christ, you know. He was also Christian. He was very mystic, and he did a lot of therapy in Paris. It was hypnosis therapy that helped his... Sometimes he had 3-4 days of depression where he had to be locked in a room and quiet. And he wrote this beautiful poem called The Hand of God, which goes in Portuguese, Na mão direita, na sua mão direita, descansou afinal meu coração. Do palácio isolado da ilusão, eu fiz a passo e passo a escada estreita. Como as flores mortais com que enfeitas o palácio infantil, o engenho vão, depois do ideal da paixão, a forma transitória e imperfeita. It's about the illusion of the palace of illusion. I came step and step the narrow steps, and I depicted from the illusion of illusions the imperfect step, step by step, in the hands of God, in the sweet, enchanted hands of God, finally rested my heart. It's very beautiful. His poems are full of wonderful sense of dreams.
Was he quite well known in his time?
Yeah, he was a very good professor of law. And he inherited a lot of money, so he always lived with lots of desire of better love and better care in the world. So he signed the Manifesto Comunista with the old Germans. And many of them were actually a bit noble, too. And he ended up committing suicide, unfortunately.
My great-grand-uncle. But what is that famous poem about the woman in the night?
Oh, yeah.
What's that called?
Num sonho todo feito de incerteza e da pura e indizível ansiedade, foi que eu vi teu olhar de piedade e mais que piedade, de tristeza. Não tinha o vulgar brilho da beleza, nem o ardor banal da mocidade. Era outra luz, outra suavidade, que até nem sei se há na natureza. Visão, visão triste e piedosa, fita-me assim calada, assim chorosa, e deixa-me sonhar a vida inteira. Ok, translation is, in a dream all made of anxiety, of uncertainty, is when I saw your eyes of beauty, and more than beauty, sadness. You didn't have the sad look of beauty, nor the ardor banality of youth. You had another light, another compassion, that I don't even know if it exists in nature. Vision full of sadness and compassion. Look at me so quiet, so cryable, and let me dream all my life.
Beautiful. Let me dream all my life. Why why would someone like that, who had such a sense of mystery, want to commit suicide? I don't understand what was going on for him.
Well, he came to New York by boat with a friend, F. H. Queiroz, another writer, and another friend. They came on a boat, and they loved New York. And then they went to Quebec. And then it took them about 8 months to return to Azores, to the island of San Miguel, and to Lisbon. And by the time he came back to the island of San Miguel, the woman he used to help, two children, he even adopted them and helped with everything. The woman was very bitchy with him, and she said, "Why did you take so long away? Me and my children are not going to visit you anymore." And he got into a deep depression with them saying that when he came to visit New York, and then they wanted him to go into the government, like one of the people there. And he decided to buy a nice gun, and he sat on the square, under the place where he sat was faith, hope, and charity. These three words were printed on the little wall. And he there killed himself.
In the public square?
Yeah.
In Lisbon?
Yeah.
In the public square of Lisbon.
Actually, he killed himself in the Saint Mike, San Miguel.
Oh, in the Azores. This was your father's brother. Your great...
My grandfather's brother. Great-grandfather's brother.
But his poetry then became well-known throughout the world.
He was already very well-known. He was loved. He was very loved by the Germans, by the French, by the Italians. He had important people working together.
Oh, he was part of the symbolist movement with the French school of poets and painters.
They loved him.
So how was it that you've kept yourself free from depression your whole life and such a kind of up, curious being of consciousness?
Well, that is a curious question, because I felt always sort of away from the times of my school friends that were all going out to the movies and talking so enthusiastic. I always liked to go to the beach alone, and I became a very good friend of Antonio Carlos Jobim, Tom Jobim, the bossa nova, the girl from Ipanema. He was my old friend since youth, and we studied with the same pianist woman, Dona Lucia Branco. Lucia Branco only taught pianists. And I was a bit detached from the youth movements. I liked to hang out with him, and then we did a big block in Carnival, with me carrying the Brazilian flag in the samba. I don't know. I always found a way to compensate my sense of emptiness in a way. We always found a way of grabbing the moment.
So you felt the emptiness, but you didn't let it affect you. Is that it, do you think?
I was very lucky because I met my husband, my first husband, Peter Pratt, in a time where the dictatorship was going to fall any moment. And the militaries came to my school and opened all our windows, doors, threw our papers on the floor. It was a horror. And me and Desi Pinhatari, my teacher, my famous teacher, and others from the Bauhaus school, we were like shocked with the brutal stuff around the dictatorships, and we didn't know much. But my uncle, who was involved with the money of Brazil, Santiago Dantas, my uncle, Titio Santiago Dantas, he died in 2 months. I think he was poisoned. I feel that. And my cousin was in jail for 8 months, and lots of boys and students were in jail. And at that time, I met Peter Pratt, and I was invited to go to Greece. So my father allowed me to go, and I ended up marrying him in Athens.
Uh-huh. So then you spent a long time in Greece and in Europe. So you've really lived on three continents. You've been in lots of your youth in South America, a lot of time in Europe, and a lot of time in North America, and then you also spent time in Asia. You've had quite a interesting life, hasn't it been? Is there anything you want to do that you haven't done?
Well, I have this desire to go, if possible, one day to Tibet and one day to India, if it happens, and one day to Egypt, but we'll see what happens. So far, I have gone to Japan, to China, to Europe, lots of places, lived in Greece.
You know, it seems like there's a spiritual community all over the planet that's awakening. And it's not the old spirituality, but it's, you know, when I travel to different places, there's a newness, there's a common presence that we recognize in each other. Even when I was in Russia, in St. Petersburg, in the 70s, and every place, in Western Europe for sure. You know, India has a bit of the old tradition. They're a bit stuck in the past, and Egypt is too a bit. But they're great countries. Those ancient pyramids and temples along the Nile are still active. You can just spend your whole day just sitting in the corner of one of those temples and feel the connection to the cosmos. It's really a great experience. But we're moving into modern times, new realities is what I call this program. So I feel like the world has yet to see the magic it's capable of. Don't you feel that way?
Yes, I do. And I had a really sad magic when I went to the Mayan island of Isla Mujeres, the island of the women. I met a girls that were a couple of girls that had a store. And they said, go to the forest, you see the beginning there, discovering a whole ancient civilization of beautiful things there. So I went and they were discovering the house of Ishel, the old Ishel. And then I came back next year to look for them and tell them that I did go. And they were both killed by a cousin that was jealous of them or because of stuff, and the store had closed and people were very depressed. The girls had told me about the secret forest were killed.
Why are you telling us this?
Because to see the house of Ishel, when me and my little daughter Willow pulled my husband and I to go in the house when the guy were discovering and the whole civilization of Ishel was in the forest after 6,000 years. It was protected during the wars and everything through the forest. And when we came in the house, we stepped in the house, it was like the flying saucer. The vibration was so intense, even though the door was very little. And when we came out of the house of Ishel with the huge rocks, and it vibrated like a magic. So when we came out of the house, my shoes vanished in the forest. They vanished. And there were about 6 to 8 birds, Quetzalcoatl. They were all singing together. It was like a dream I will never forget.
So what was the point, though? Did that give you some inspiration for the future? Tell me how that affected you.
Well, it affected me because we went to the other place, the other beautiful a structure where she was buried with her husband, who was the king of Mexico. She lived in the island, but he came to visit her all the time. They were very in love, and she was magic. She helped women. And her teeth were found in the tomb. And they gave us her teeth to hold, her perfect teeth, perfect. And the husband, besides, lots of treasures that they were buried with treasures. A German guy had passed by and taken everything to Germany. Unfortunately, the boy was saying they just robbed when we were having lunch. someone came by and took. Anyway, it was just a joy to see for the first time, we were the first people to be near such treasures.
You mean this was an old Mayan princess from 6,000 years old that you were
yes.
in that
yes.
excavation?
Yes.
I see. So, anything else you would like to do or say to people about your spiritual experiences? Because I know you have a few more stories. So just because I...
Go ahead.
Well, what it made me change my sense of present, future, and dream level when we go to other places like the Mayans, really believe we leave our bodies when we dream at night. We already travel. And being there, the old Mayans already knew that 6,000 years ago. And they cured the women. Like, Ishel was a very important princess who did lots of healings to women through dreams, especially. Through dreams, lots can be achieved and understood and lived. Like, we live through dreams, too, in other realms.
Yeah.
Totally.
No, it's true. And lots of the... books and the wisdom traditions. Actually, I was just reading a book by Jane Roberts, Seth, the Seth material, and Seth in The Nature of the Psyche says dreams are actually ways we unlock our mind to learn more. You know, in our conscious reality, we get so fixed about the way things are, but in our dreams, they let in new information, so we start to evolve, actually, consciously in those dream realms. So I think listening to the dreams, and I think listening to the cultural dreams, you know, and I think we're dreaming new dreams as a culture. This is what I'm interested in doing this program. How can we tell new stories and new dreams, and what can we open up to on other levels of consciousness? So you've had a quite an interesting time doing that, and you're still on a journey.
I have lots of friends in Brazil that put little lovely stones always in a bowl of water, never just standing on the wood, never, always on water.
Why?
Because that creates a very important connection with the spiritual level. You start having different dreams, different experiences, in depending on the moon level, with the stones on the rocks, especially on the water, especially on the full moon time.
Wait. So you say you put a stone in a bowl
like
of water,
precious stone,
in a little water,
sitting on water,
sitting in a bowl of water at night during the full moon, and that will pull a kind of higher spiritual experience to our dream state.
It is very important to have the precious stones in water. Like this. All stones we have, amethysts, the white long ones, all colors, all levels. When we have them in the water, it attracts a different language in the mystical realm, in terms of dreams, in terms of visions, in terms of house energy, because the waters can listen and can receive and transport to us better. It's like having a waterfall. You know, if we had a little waterfall in the city would feel better. But even when we have a false waterfall, like in Italy, there are so many, and the area feels very enlightened. So if in that water, even a bowl of water, we put our stones, the communion with the spirit gets much better. I learned that with some practical people that practice magic stuff. And I know that. It's true.
Wait, is this a traditional Brazilian practice? Is this a medicine?
Well, it's only traditional with the very knowledgeable people that are already in the everyday pattern. They know so many simple things like water and stones are the most important elements. And precious stones, of course, too.
Mm-hmm. Wow, very interesting. That's a little piece that people can take with them and use and apply. I mean, there's actually is a science to mysticism. Everyone just says it's mystical, but they don't realize that we are consciously affecting other levels of reality by doing these things. Like Carlos Castaneda said in one of his books, if you have a visitor in your house and you want them to leave and they don't want to leave, you know what you do? He says, put a little drop of your pee in the corners of your room. And he says, that will make your unwanted visitors leave.
Really?
Isn't that interesting?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That sounds highly mystic. Yeah.
Yeah,
because we joke in Brazil, you know, our original nation is called Tupi. Tupi and Guarani. So we always joke with Tupi or not Tupi. That's the question.
Thank you. I've been talking with Virginia Quintal. She is a native of Brazil, but she's now residing in Vancouver, and she often visits New York and around the world. She is a mystic and a painter. Just tell us a little bit about your painting before we go.
Well, I had a wonderful experience this summer in Carnival. The band of, we were making a homage to France, so the president was of France was watching us, and we were representing in our school, Grande Rio, the history of France. So my daughter and Narcisa, a wonderful Brazilian socialite, they bought for me the costume of the painter of France. And in the music was a very mystical reality. The music was all about Degas, Degas, Degas here, Degas there. And my name was in the midst of the song. And I thought, what? I almost went into a trance. I thought, this is like mystic reality, me in the avenue here and them singing about Degas, Degas. Because when I was little, my father used to call me, Degas, wake up, wake up. And Degas, and here's the whole story of art. And whew, I nearly went off to another realm, but it did happen this year.
Mm-hmm. Right, you have some mystical connection
yeah.
to the painter Degas.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, my favorite movie about the carnival is Black Orpheus. You know that that's an incredible movie.
I used to go a lot to the house of Vinicius de Moraes when I was 19, 18, because my first lover in Brazil, who was a painter, Ivan Marchetti, a wonderful painter, he took me there, and Vinicius used to say, I want you to look at the tree of the oranges. Look carefully at the oranges. And years later, I discovered that my ancestors in Old Holland, the orange is the holy fruit there. The worship fruit is orange.
Mm. Well, thank you. Thank you for all those interesting stories. Virginia, I've been, I'll be trying to get in touch with Philip Lippitz, who I've started this program, trying to look at his conference call, but that didn't work. So Virginia filled in here, and I thought it was a very interesting program. But next week, I'm going to have a Bharavi Ma on the program, and she is a expert in the ancient tantric science of Tantra, and it's the ancient Indian science, so she will be the guest on New Realities on December 15th here on BBS Radio. Thank you for listening. This is Alan Steinfeld, and if you have any comments, you could email me at newrealities@earthlink.net and check my website, newrealities.com. Thanks for listening. Email me with comments, newrealities@earthlink.net. Thank you. Thank you, Don and Seth and everyone at BBS Radio.